Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by getting an update on the situation in Afghanistan and the Taliban's attempts to control even more of the country. Today's guest, independent journalist Ali Latifi, says districts are falling, but security forces and the public are putting up a fight and trying to take them back. Still, thousands of people are fleeing their homes to escape the violence. According to Afghan officials, more than 22,000 Afghan families have fled Kandahar, the second largest city in Afghanistan. The UN says 20 to 30,000 people are fleeing every week. At this rate, 1.5 million Afghans could be headed towards Europe by the end of the year. In a report from Kandahar for Al Jazeera, journalists Ali Latifi and Abdul Matin Amiri write, "Last week, Kausar Sama and her family packed their belongings and got on a flight to the capital city of Kabul. For the 21-year-old and her family, life in the southern city of Kandahar had become dangerous as the Taliban has pushed into the districts surrounding Afghanistan's second largest city in recent weeks. Sama said, it's too risky for people to send their children to school. You would only go to the market if you absolutely had to. And even then, so many of the stores would be shut. Life has stopped." Ali Latifi is an independent journalist based in Kabul. His writing has appeared in a number of publications, including the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times. Hi, Ali. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, Ali. There's just so much to talk about. A lot has changed since you joined the show. In the latest piece you wrote for Al Jazeera, you write that the war has just grown more violent and traveling to various districts is proving more difficult. Before we dive in, can you just tell us again, who are today's Taliban and what has really changed?
The Taliban, it's a mix of different forces. There's definitely a lot that are from the country, absolutely, that are from the areas where they are taking over. There are also foreign fighters among them. If you speak to people in these areas, in these districts, and you ask them, they will say that they have seen Iranian, Pakistani fighters along with them, that they've seen their weapons with them. So I think the difference is that now they're much more determined to consolidate as much territory as possible.
One of the people you interviewed, Amini, says that in Mirwa Mina, a community 15 minutes from the city, residents have noticed a change in the Taliban's demeanor. Amina said they're not the same Taliban as even 2 weeks ago. Can you tell us more about that?
So he was saying that in Mirwais Mina, which is maybe about 20 kilometers from the city, which is a residential area, that they, in the past, you know, the Taliban, they wouldn't disturb you if they didn't suspect you of anything. You know, that you would see them around and nothing would happen to you. But now they're becoming much more aggressive. There have been reports of them digging into the ground to plant landmines. There have been reports. One of the girls we spoke to, Zainab, she was also from that area. She said that they entered their house and it was only the women inside. And they said, "Don't worry, we're not going to do anything to you. Just tell us where the roof is. Like, show us where the roof is." And they went on the roof, and because their roof was so high, they had a very good vantage point of different police buildings. And they basically started to fire from there. They started to fire rockets. They started to fire guns. And they just carried out their operation from this family's house.
Tell us what is involved in traveling to different districts to do these interviews.
I mean, Matin went to speak to them, but it's very difficult. A lot of times, even though he's in Kandahar, he would find them in the city, like they had just fled the city, and then, you know, he talked to them that way or over the phone. Because at this point, There are checkpoints, and a lot of times you can get through the checkpoints if you don't have, you know, if they don't suspect you of being affiliated with the government or the security forces. But the bigger problem is that there are landmines on the road. And this was the point that they were making about the IEDs in Mirwais Mina, is that once you start to lay down IEDs, then these people can't leave. You know, they're essentially stuck in that area. So traveling to the district, it can be very tricky. It can be very difficult. And obviously the placement of things like IEDs has made it much more difficult than it was in the past. As long as you didn't have, you know, something that tied you to the government, you could be okay. But now it's really just the risk of, you know, driving over a landmine. Mm.
You report that according to the UN, the first 6 months of this year saw 501 people killed by IEDs and 1,457 injured.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, it makes people getting out much more difficult. For instance, last year when we spoke to families who had left Lashkargah, the capital of Helmand, they were trying to get to the city of Khandar, and they said that, again, because of the placement of IEDs, they would have to go in basically on the side roads and the fields and things like that to avoid the main road, because they knew that the main road would be full of landmines, which would make the trip even longer, more expensive, more difficult. You know, it would make drivers much more reluctant to go on those roads and to take people. So it really affects people's mobility.
Ali, it's devastating to think that so many people feel that they have no choice but to flee. Can you just tell us what is involved in that process?
In that process, it's basic. A lot of times what ends up happening is that it will be the women and the children who leave. Like this was the issue with the people who had fled Lashkargah last year, is that, you know, because they felt that if there were older men there, they could try and protect the land, they could try and, you know, fight back, or maybe if they were really old, the Taliban might not do anything to them. So a lot of times, and you have to remember that a lot of people, the men and their family, they might be in the security forces, or they could have been killed or injured along the way anyway. So a lot of time when you're talking about people leaving, it's generally women and children.
The UN says 20 to 30,000 people are leaving every week. So can you give us more information about this? Where are they going?
So part of that is internal displacement. So they're leaving the districts and trying to go to the nearest safest city. The other part is if they can find a way to leave the country, they will. But that's becoming not only because, you know, ground travel can be very, for instance, in the north, you know, even if you wanted to go to, say, Uzbekistan by land, the districts around it are not necessarily safe as they were before. And then if you want to go further than, say, Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, then you are stuck in basically this long, winding visa process. So a lot of people are trying to go to Turkey. And it's gotten to the point where different commission companies are taking $3,000 to $7,000 to process your visas immediately, you know, as quickly as possible. $3,000 for 2 weeks, $7,000 for 2 days, and then that's per passport. So for a family, you know, that's a lot of money. And so that means only if you have the means. You have to remember that people who leave the country, those are people who have the means to get a passport, who have some money, who, you know, you have to have that option. You have to have the ability to do that. For a lot of people, the only option is to basically to go to another district or another city.
And you have said that these countries in Europe and Turkey know the state of what's happening uh-huh. in Afghanistan, and yet they have done very little to make life better for people there. Can you talk more about that?
Well, they were part of that coalition, right, of 40 nations. And, you know, they have been accused of rights abuses in the past. You know, the Germans have, the Australians have, the United States and the UK certainly have. And it's just this idea of the fact that, you know, for instance, like today there was that headline that, what was it, like 200 or 2,000 people just arrived in the U.S. today. You know, people who are essentially SIVs who had been interpreters and worked with the foreign forces. You know, and that's really the legacy of their war, is that you're having to evacuate these people because 20 years later, it's not safe enough for them to stay. You know, if they were to stay, they feel as if they would be at risk, as if they could be killed by the Taliban. And that's something that, you know, we reported from Khandad, where one of the families was given assurances that, you know, nothing will happen to your son. When the son came back 4 days later, he just, like, they took him in the middle of the night and they haven't seen him since. So that's what I mean by that, is that, you know, if this mission had succeeded, you wouldn't need to do these things.
This is important, Ali, because you commented on a tweet by Secretary Antony Blinken, who said to the first group of Afghan special immigrant applicants arriving in the U.S. Yeah. as part of yeah. Operation Allies Refuge, welcome to your new home. And this is getting a lot of attention. And as you say, and as you tweeted, this is the result of the 20-year war. They couldn't secure Afghanistan enough to allow for the men and women who helped them to stay in their homeland. Think about that. So what would you say about the media coverage of this and how it should be covered?
I think it should be covered in that perspective. You know, it's sort of like, oh, look, we're giving these visas and they're coming and we're welcoming them. Well, but why do you have to give these visas? Why is nobody talking about that? Why is it that, you know, right now by the airport in Herat, one of the biggest cities in the country, there's active battles, the Taliban have gotten there. They've blocked the airport road. The airport is closed. You know, they were able to fire onto a UN compound that's right next to the airport. So I think this is, you know, it's not necessarily like, this is sort of the least you could have done, you know, because if you couldn't make the situation, if you couldn't lay the groundwork for them to be okay in their own country, then that means, you know, that has to lead to the question of, well, then what did you achieve? You know, what did you really accomplish for these people?
Mm. Yeah, today we're speaking with Ali Latifi, an independent journalist in Kabul, and I hope you can read his recent pieces. Find them at yourcallradio.org. If you have any questions for Ali about what's happening on the ground in Afghanistan, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You can also tweet at yourcallradio. You know, it's kind of amazing, Ali, to look at Antony Blinken's tweet and to think about how quickly we forget. I mean, given that this is getting attention, just 2 years ago, in December 2019, the Washington Post wrote that long package of pieces called The Afghanistan Papers, At War with the Troops. With the Truth. U.S. officials constantly said they were making progress. They were not, and they knew it. And yet this barely gets attention today.
Yeah, and that's exactly, you know, a lot of it is doom and gloom, that they act as if the Taliban have already reached the presidential palace, and that has not happened yet. The country has not been, you know, taken over. It has not fallen. And I think presenting that kind of an image is very dangerous, because it only creates more fear and uncertainty for the people who can't get out. And I think that definitely for the U.S. media, the more productive, constructive sort of angles to be taking is, you know, because a lot of people ask, like, what's going to happen? And nobody knows what's going to happen. But I think what needs to be asked is, what did happen? And how did we end up in this situation? How did we end up where the U.S. is claiming they're going to also give special visas to women and human rights workers and journalists and other influential people who may be at risk if the group that they made a peace deal with actually does come to full power?
Yeah. Can you remind us about the peace deal? Because that also got a lot of attention in the U.S. press.
So in February 2020, the Trump administration signed a peace deal with the Taliban that laid the groundwork for their withdrawal. They were supposed to leave in May. That got extended to September. And then President Biden reduced it again to the end of next month, to the end of August. And essentially, based on that agreement, the Taliban said they would no longer attack foreign targets. But what they have been doing is attacking Afghan targets. And they have been, creating insecurity for the people, for the civilians. And there's no real account for that. You know, there was no, they did have a reduction in violence in the lead up to that signing. But beyond that, there was no other condition. There was no other measure. And there still is no other measure. I mean, just recently, the U.S. and a handful of other NATO countries put out this statement condemning the Taliban attacks and calling for a ceasefire. But again, to a lot of people here, it's just another statement that's too late because, you know, they still have theoretically the power to put pressure on the Taliban, to put pressure on the country supporting them, to, you know, really sort of oblige them to some kind of a ceasefire or a real reduction in violence, something to act in good faith. But there's nothing like that yet.
Can you tell us how life has changed for people who are living under the Taliban?
That's hard to say because, getting to those areas is difficult. But for instance, in that story from Kandahar, people talked about it. You know, they talked about, there was the one girl who said, you know, that they basically came to their house and, took up a post on their roof. There was the other family who said their son disappeared, despite them sending letters saying that, you know, as long as you come and report to us and tell us what you did, we won't harm you. There was another family who said, you know, it was one of the sons with his wife and the mother on a motorcycle, essentially just trying to like cross the street, and they got shot at by the Taliban, and what they say is the Taliban, and badly injured. So, you know, that in itself says a lot. And then even in areas that aren't fully under the Taliban control, the problem is that it's become a propaganda war. And people, you know, there's massive uncertainty. You know, people don't know if there will be a civil war. They don't know if the Taliban will take over. And then they don't know if there actually will be a peace settlement. And that affects people's psyche. You know, everybody is constantly asking what's going to happen. Or how can we get out? You know, what do we have to do to get the reason that, you know, a Turkish visa can now cost $7,000 a person is specifically because of that fear and that uncertainty.
Just 4 hours ago, Ali, you tweeted that you spoke to a friend on the front line in Herat, and he says the situation is really bad, rockets and gunfire. People are afraid to go out, even in the city.
Yeah, and he just called me. He was just going back towards his house, and he was saying the firing is continuing, the battle is continuing, and you know, when we were speaking, you could hear the fire, you could hear everything going on. And again, this is, you know, one of the biggest cities in the country. It's essentially, it's like, you know how like SFO is not in the city of San Francisco, right? It's like a probably 20-30 minute drive from Millbrae to the city. It's the same thing from the airport to the city of Herat. So now imagine that, you know, an armed opposition group is in Millbrae, you know?
Mm. Ali, last week, Nazar Mohammed, a well-known Afghan comedian, was murdered by the Taliban, and the Taliban filmed his last moments as he was brutally slapped and abused before he was shot. This footage got a lot of attention on social media, and people said this is a vivid example of what happens when the Taliban take over. Can you tell us more about what happened to him and how people are reacting?
So the thing we have to remember is that he was part of the police, and the police in Kandahar, under the former police commander, Abdul Razik, they were known to be very brutal themselves. And the police commander, Razik, he was credited with bringing safety and security to the city, but he was also accused of abuses against people he claimed were Taliban, against rivals, of disappearances of rivals. And also, you know, it would be very easy for him to say X person is a Talib and, you know, kill him or disappear him without any evidence. And so like this also affected how the Taliban saw this comedian, because they saw him as part of that police force. And so they themselves were also taking out their sort of aggression and grudge on, you know, just the comedian who needed to be part of the police to make money. And so, you know, it shows sort of how the abuses of both sides, or the accusations of abuses and assumptions that everyone is involved in them, are leading to things like this.
Today we're speaking with independent journalist Ali Latifi about the current situation in Afghanistan. Ali, this week China's foreign minister met with senior leaders of the Taliban, and Chinese foreign minister said that the Taliban is an important military and political force in Afghanistan. This seems to be signaling some sort of active involvement. What are your thoughts on this? What is China looking for here? And what do you think its endgame is in Afghanistan?
I mean, China is looking allegedly to make sure that the Taliban don't support Uyghur separatist movements. And also, I think the bigger issue with this, in what it highlights, you know, the BRICS also had said something a couple of weeks ago that if the Taliban come to power and they respect a certain level of human rights, you know, we will interact with them. And I think what it really shows is that the Taliban has been very successful in the last 2 years of going around the region and making themselves into diplomats, into politicians, and making themselves seem like a viable political choice. You know, on the one hand, yes, it's true, the Taliban is a reality of Afghanistan. It is a reality that everyone will eventually have to contend with. But the fact that they have been so good at traveling to all of these countries and making themselves look like a legitimate political and military force, you know, while all these countries are allied with the government itself, it shows a double game that's being played everywhere right now. And I mean, it was the same thing the U.S. was doing. They were having negotiations with the Taliban with no real Afghan government representation at all at that table. You know, they didn't include them at all. The deal was made between these two. It was made between Washington and the Taliban.
Let's take a caller. Let's hear from Robert in San Rafael. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. I have two questions. One, would it be a fair statement to say that now, after 20 years, there's been one essential generational change, from the beginning of a generational change, and a second generational change would need to take place in order for real change in that country to take place, because there's still an imbalance? And number two, because I'm very happy that you, of course, brought up the subject of why is there not an Afghanistan that can stand on its own merit, what was done in those 20 years. And the second question is, would this be actually a very, very excellent place for the United Nations of the world to unite together to establish a country that can make its own choices in a more peaceful and progressive manner, rather than leaning on only one country to dominate, which all leads to its own problems?
Well, there were 40 countries here. You know, all of NATO was here, all of its allies were here, and they all were involved in different areas of this country and provided funding and support and military support. So I think that's already been tried. So I don't know what difference the United Nations could make. I think the issue now is that whoever is involved, whoever's trying to do something here, needs to finally be genuine and act in good faith, which has not happened up until now. And, you know, the other issue is that we know that the Taliban are being supported by our neighbors. We know that they're being supported by Pakistan. We know that they're being supported by Iran. And yet there's no legitimate pressure being placed on them, not by the United Nations, not by NATO, not by the United States, not by Germany, not by the EU. So that's a major issue. That is one way that they could easily contribute to really try and at least take away some of the support that this group has, some of the foreign support. As for generational change, I mean, there's always been generational change in this country. I think there's an unfortunate assumption in this country that the Taliban somehow were here much longer. I mean, we forget that they were only here for 5 years. And yes, there was a civil war before that. Yes, there was a Soviet occupation before that. But, you know, in the 60s, we had a constitution that was working toward, that was moving towards democracy, that gave women and minorities rights, that, you know, allowed for more representation, that allowed for some level of freedom of speech. So it's not as if any of these things are all that new. It's just that they have to be supported properly and they have to be given a chance to actually flourish, you know, because if you're supporting one warlords on one side and then, you know, saying you want democracy in the country, that sends a clearly mixed message. And if you're not, you know, if you're allowing for a corrupt government to continue without, you know, every time there was one of these big summits in the world about funding and pledges, they kept saying like the government has to meet these sorts of anti-corruption goals. Otherwise, you know, we cut our funding, but they never, sometimes they cut funding by certain percentages, but they never like put any real tangible markers on those things or took any real action for those sorts of things.
Ali, before we let you go, final thoughts on what you're hearing from young people?
I mean, this is the other thing, is that a lot of these young people either weren't in the country during the Taliban, or they weren't alive then, or they, if they weren't alive during the Taliban, then they certainly weren't alive for the civil war or the Soviet occupation. And so I think that in itself can sort of exacerbate the fear even more that, you know, just how bad it can be, because they've all heard stories, but they haven't necessarily lived through them. But at the same time, you know, there are incredible young people doing amazing things. I'm working on a story right now about, you know, two young guys who are MMA fighters and, you know, who are unbelievably popular all over the country. One of them was saying that when he was in his home village, he actually ran into a guy who turned out to be a Talib who was like, "Oh, I saw your fight and you should know everybody here supports you." So, you know, the people are trying to remain hopeful as much as possible, but it's difficult.
Well, Ali, we're definitely going to do an entire hour on Afghanistan soon, and we'd love to have you back. Thank you so much for your reporting, as always, and thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Ali Latifi is an independent journalist based in Kabul, and you can find his stories at yourcallradio.org. We did not have time to talk with Ali about the U.S. military's drone assassination program, which really affected so many Afghans. Yesterday, we talked about former Air Force intelligence analyst Daniel Hale, who leaked classified information about that assassination program. On Tuesday, he was sentenced to 45 months in prison, and you can find that show at yourcallradio.org. Sorry we had to say goodbye to Ali, so we didn't get all of your phone calls, but we will definitely do an entire show about Afghanistan soon. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the Capitol attack House hearing and the current state of white supremacist groups in the U.S. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.